Good morning. We're going to get started. We have some people missing, and we anticipate more will filter in as we get going. I get to say hi to everyone. Thank you all for being here. Appreciate it. Today is Thursday, October 10th, 2019. The time is 9:55 a.m., and we will begin the meeting for the Regional Growth Committee at Wasatch Front Regional Council. Our numbers are a little smaller, but we're going to do our introductions anyway. I never like to assume that everybody knows who each other is, so if we can just quickly go around the room. Let's start with Katie over here, and we'll go around the table, and then we'll go around the perimeter. Okay?
Katie Gerard with Wasatch Front staff.
Gary Rescue Cross City, representing the Liberty
Mark Allen, Mayor of Washington Terrace.
I'll be using the mics. This is Carrie Doan from Utah Transit Authority, representing Laura Hansen.
Jeff Scott, Black Thunder County.
Tina Cannon, Margate County.
Ted Moulton, Deputy Director at Wasatch Front Regional Council.
Don Ramsey, Mayor of South Jordan City. I serve on WFRC, representing the Utah League of Cities and Towns as well.
Andrew Gruber, Executive Director at Wasatch Front Regional Council.
Reed Ewing, University of Utah, Department of City and Metropolitan Planning.
Service. Mayor Wilson, Jenny Wilson, Sully County.
Ari Gruening and Visit Utah.
Evan Curtis, State Planning Coordinator with the Governor's Office.
Ben Hewitt, UDOT Program Development Director.
Led RV City for Salt Lake.
Yeah, Bob Dandorn, Morris City.
Jenny Reese, Mayor of Cedar Hills, representing MAG.
Okay, let's come back around to this front corner. I know we're going to go around the perimeter of the room.
Mary Pratt, Wasatch Front staff.
Linda Johnson, the public.
Roger Warrior, Utahns for Better Transportation.
Terry Wool, UDOT. Andrea Olson.
Richard Brockmeyer, you got?
Junior, Bad Longer, Planning, Wasatch Front. Ian Abriel, Long Range Planning, Wasatch Front.
George Outer, Long Range Planning, Wasatch Front.
Travis Jensen, I work for WCC, WCEC Engineers.
Eric Finger, Salt Lake County.
Helen Peters, Transportation Program Manager, Salt Lake County.
Scott Kessman, Wasatch Front Regional Council staff.
Ed Hacker with Wasatch Front staff.
Steve Call, Federal Highway Administration.
Shane Pace, City Manager, Farmington.
Andy Holka, Knight City.
Scott Pence, WFRC staff.
Megan Townsend, WFRC staff.
Okay, thank you all for being here. We appreciate it. First item on the agenda, after introductions, is our consent agenda. Are there any concerns, anything that anybody would like to go over regarding the minutes from our August 15th, 2019 meeting? Seeing none, I will entertain a motion to approve these minutes.
So moved.
I didn't see who was that, Tina?
Yeah.
Okay. Is there a second?
Second.
The second by Mayor Wilson. Any further discussion? All in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Those minutes are approved. Next is our public comment portion of the meeting. We love that somebody's here representing the public. We're all part of the residents of this area, and we're all part of the public, but I love that that's your official role here, really. So if there is anyone from the public, which includes all of you, who would like to address this body, we will open public comment. The time is now yours. Okay, we'll look forward to it. Thank you. We will close the public comment and move on to item three, the Wasatch Choice Vision 2050 implementation update. As the steering committee for this, we share the Wasatch Front, the Wasatch Choice Vision with WFRC, and it's been being shared everywhere. This is our shared plan, and Regional Growth Committee will continue our conversation as this progresses. We're going to hear an update on the implementation workshops from Julie Bornstedt first, and then we're going to discuss the TLC program, which really is available to help our communities implement this plan. this vision. And then afterwards, Megan Townsend will give us a look at the current state of the TLC program. And forgive me, is it Neda or Nita? I want to pronounce it right.
Neda.
Neda?
Yeah.
Welcome. She's a new face here with us.
Right.
Thanks for being here. Neda will share findings that she's learned by looking at programs like TLC from across the country.
Okay, great. So first, it's important to remember that as the area grows and develops, we have a plan, and that plan is the Wasatch Choice 2050 vision, which was adopted by our regional council in May of this year. That vision was developed in partnership with key stakeholders throughout the region, and more importantly, with you as our local communities and counties. The vision was built on four key strategies: providing transportation choices, supporting housing options, preserving open space, and then the crux of the plan is really linking economic development with transportation and housing decisions. That translates into the idea of where it matters. That development doesn't need to occur everywhere throughout our region, but if we can concentrate that development in key centers throughout the region, whether that's a metropolitan, urban, city, or neighborhood center. And the vision outlines where those centers should be located based on local input, and also outlines the future for transportation, whether that's roads, transit, or active transportation. So as we move from planning into implementation, WFRC in partnership with ULCT, UDOT and UTA are hosting 10 workshops between now and the early part of December throughout the Wasatch Front, having conversations about implementation opportunities and challenges, funding, and data needs. We've had 4 of those already, and we have 6 more over the next 2-ish months. So if you haven't heard about these, please seek out someone at WFRC. We can tell you what it is, get you in touch with someone who can send out invitations to you or your local staff. So the other thing that we're doing is trying to provide data that's useful to local communities as they begin implementation. So the idea here is that we need to understand where we are and where we're going before we take off. And the first part of that is we've created a State of the Centers report, which is online now. It's giving you key indicators for every metropolitan, urban, and some select city centers throughout the region. And those indicators are things like population and employment densities, mode share, street connectivity, what we're calling walking opportunities, safety, land use mix, housing and transportation costs, access to open space and recreation, commercial market value, and access to opportunities for the center and compared to your city as a whole and then the regional average. The idea here is that the center really should be more concentrated in activity than the city, and then you can compare that to how the rest of the region is doing. The other thing is for individual cities, we're discussing and distributing information at our workshops on those same metrics for each of the cities, and this will be posted also online after the workshops are done. But we're discussing and distributing that at each workshop. So as you think about these metrics and the 10 Wasatch Choice goals, are there other pieces of data that you feel like would be important for us to work on analyzing or to hand to you as you develop general plans, small area plans, et cetera?
Julie, will you go back one slide as they think about that question? So these are, again, these are pieces of data that we're discussing at the workshops, and again, they will be online later. And part of this question is, as you, as communities think about, okay, well, perhaps it's time for us to update our general plan, or we're working on planning for or zoning for, let's say, a center. This is data that is useful for us. Are there other things as you think about, let's say, a general plan update that you would add into this list that you think, boy, it would be nice if we had fill in the blank piece of information?
I mean, one of the things we're looking at in our city is housing affordability, and I don't see that on here. Do you have measures of that and how we're doing with our affordable housing plans?
We can look into that. I think we do have some measures on it. It was something we wanted to add to the Senator's report, and we just haven't gotten to it before. We wanted to release the bulk of that information. So we're not looking at it, but can we break that down? Housing affordability. We'll look into it.
And then you may have questions about what is being shown on this as well, and how these things fit in. One of the interesting things that will happen with the implementation of Senate Bill 34 that has to do with moderate income housing is there will be, each of you are going to have to update those communities that are over 5,000 people. Will be updating your moderate income housing plan. I'm bringing this up because that information can be compiled, and we can do things to understand, you know, what are communities around the region doing, and then you can take a look and think about, well, what's the lay of the land in terms of the variety of responses that communities are doing on SB 34. So that's something that I don't know, Mayor Harvey, if that gets at your question at all, but that's just brainstorming on something we could do.
No, I just know we're tasked with it, and as we're going into general plans, I think it would be helpful.
Well, yeah, as you continue to use this data or think about these things, just let us know. We're open to any discussion throughout, as long as we're here, time and history.
So, yeah, I just want to thank you for this. I think about our efforts at Salt Lake County as we look at parks, connections to, you know, the resources we have to various communities. So the idea that we can overlay this with our parks master plan, our rec plan, some of our other regional plans is incredibly helpful. So we'll take this back and make sure we're connecting at Salt Lake County and make sure we're all on the same page. And this is a great framework for us to build off of.
It's a great segue, because I was just going to tell you where you can find the data. So either it's on the county or anyone. If you go to our website and you click on the maps and data, this regional performance measures is where you can find the state of the center's information, as well as detailed analysis about that access to open space and recreation. It's where we'll post the city-specific information after the workshops. The general plan data and map resources is where you can find socioeconomic data, access to opportunities, other things to help in general planning, but specifically about implementing SB 34. And then GIS and data library is where you can find a slew of information that we produce, not only in spreadsheet or Google Earth, but also GIS data. So sort of any level of expertise who wants to explore this data can get it there. And I'll turn it over to Megan.
Sorry, question,
yep.
Julie?
Yep.
So in the data, something like mode choice, is it explained exactly what that is? Is it L trips? Is it work trips? I mean, will that be in the library?
Yeah, we can probably put the mode choice on. It's not yet in the data library, but the mode choice that we're using for the state of the centers and the city specific information is daily trips. So it's all day trips.
All purposes.
All purpose, all day trips, yeah. But we have that information for home-based work, home-based others, school trips, peak hour, off-peak, whatever way you want to break that down. Thanks.
Yeah. Can I make a comment?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to build on what Mayor Wilson was saying. Her comment about park space and green space, we've talked in this group a lot about what we call access to opportunities. And we typically talk about that in the context of where does somebody live and how many jobs can they get to within a certain amount of time? Or the converse of that, if you locate a business in a particular place, how many customers or workers can access that business within a reasonable amount of time? And that's about where people live, where they work, and the transportation system. But it's not limited to jobs. It also can be a measure of access to green space, to parks, and to trails. And that's one of the things I know that we're working on and continuing to build out the data resources. So if you live in X location, what is your access to parks and to open space? And then the sort of converse of that, as any of you are planning for trails or parks or playgrounds in your communities, what are the sort of gaps, the missing places for people to access green space? So that we're trying to build out data that all of the communities can use when you're doing all the pieces of your planning, not just for residential or job creation, but also for parks and open space. The other thing I want to note is that this notion of coordinating around this broader regional vision and then what's happening at the local level is just so important. I know, again, for like Salt Lake County, and Helena's here, that the funds that Salt Lake County is awarding to local communities through its funding sources, they're specifically looking at where are the Wasatch Choice Centers and our transportation projects tying in with Wasatch Choice Centers. And, you know, UDOT is utilizing in their new prioritization criteria, which they're going to talk about in a few minutes, access questions to jobs. And so all of these things, I feel like we are getting woven together more and more as time goes on. And I want to thank Julie and the rest of the team. We're working to make this kind of data available. So as individual communities are updating their general plans or thinking about development strategies, that you can feed that data into your own local planning.
Excellent. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, Julie, thank you. While Megan walks up here, I just want to put a plug in for the implementation workshops. This plan is our plan, and I have my own council member who at a meeting recently said, you know, I think we need to have some input on what this plan is. Well, we do have some input on what that plan is, but we don't all recognize it enough to take advantage of giving our feedback and providing it. Now, this plan's been approved by this body, by the Wasatch Front Regional Council, but these implementation workshops really are invaluable, and so I would just like to put in a plug. Try to get there. Try to get your people there. Get senior staff there. Get your councils there. Try to get your people there, because it's going to take all of us to succeed at this, and the framework is in place. So with that, Megan, go ahead.
Thank you, Mayor. So as you're thinking about the Wasatch Choice vision and what that means for your community, the Transportation and Land Use Connection Program is here to help you do just that and think about how the Wasatch Choice vision can be implemented in your community. So this is our Planning Technical Assistance Program. We actually just got 2020 letters of intent. So we'll be reviewing those with our partners, UTA, UDOT, Salt Lake County, this upcoming month, and inviting those communities to apply. And those projects are really great. Every year we get really great projects, and many of them tie in with our Wasatch Choice Centers. So I want to talk a little bit about, you know, how we've began to measure progress for this program. Beginning with, so implementing the Wasatch Choice, that is directly in the mission of the Transportation and Land Use Connection Program. That's why it's here. It's here to implement the vision and to help your communities solve some of your planning challenges. 30 of our small area plans we've funded through the program. Of those, 93% are located in a Wasatch Choice for 2050 center. So we really are taking a deeper dive into these centers and helping communities figure those out and implementing the vision in another way. So 42 of the 62 communities in the Wasatch Front area have completed or are in progress of completing an active transportation plan, and TLC funded 26 of those communities to work on figuring active transportation out in their communities. So that's 68% of our region is working on an active transportation plan, or they have one in place. And that's a number we want to help you to grow. So another thing we've looked at is, now this program has been around since 2014. Some of those 2014, 2015 projects have had the opportunity to make some real impacts on the ground. And so we've taken 8 of those and kind of kicked off our real project performance tracking. So the first of these metrics that I want to talk about is our transportation choice tracking. So what are these centers looking like? What do these small areas look like? And of the 8 that we looked at from 2014 and 2015 award years, meaning they might have been plans adopted in 2016 or 2017, right? Of those 8, all of them have a major transit investment corridor as defined by SB 34. So that might be core route bus or anything kind of greater than that, right? Located within the project boundaries. So these are all on regional access points, right? Another metric is land efficiency, right? So development in centers is where a community is choosing to grow. It's where they're choosing to put that economic development and growth. And it allows the rest of the city to kind of do something different. But this land efficiency metric from 2012 to 2018, so that's the data we have available, the 8 small areas have absorbed 5,200,000 square feet of development, and that's an increase of 36%. So this is a metric we want to continue to look at. You know, what does it really mean to use land efficiently? So we'd love your input on that. And the last one is market growth. So from 2012 to 2018, the 8 small areas have seen a 64% increase in market value. So a lot of what we do with these plans is we go in, we look at an area, and we do market analysis, a lot of community outreach, and we think, you know, what's the highest and best use for this area? And we put together plans and documents and materials that all support growth in that market, and sometimes change the way the development community looks at that area, or the way the city has ordinances for that area. So this market growth, we like to think that the transportation and land use connection projects had something to do with that. So we've done 79 projects through the program. We funded 79. We're about to come on to another year of projects. And we want to continue to track how these grow and change. So this is just the beginning of us starting to look at that, and we'd really love your input. These are some of the indicators that we're considering. I know it's a long list, but we're also tying this in. We're going to be tying this in more with the State of the Centers effort to measure progress in the Wasatch Choice 2050 centers. So we have, you know, we measure how projects are moving along. You know, maybe we did a small area plan and that city is now working on rezoning that area to reflect the small area plan. New housing units within a half mile of a major transportation facility area of that center. New jobs within a half mile. The share of the citywide growth, so how much of growth in that city is going to that center where they're planning for growth. And others like mode split, reduced parking from conventional rates, and that's of course just in their ordinances, right? Some of our projects include a parking study where we're taking a look at, you know, how much parking are you using in your context-specific centers, and how much do you need to require in the future. Increase of miles planned of built bicycle infrastructure or other pedestrian amenities, right? Might be trails. And if you've updated your plan or zoning with more building diversity. So those are just things we're starting to look at. We really want to make sure that the metrics we're looking at reflect the effort that the city put into the plan and what that plan says. Ted.
Mayor, can I make a quick interjection? Just as a reminder about the Transportation Land Use Connection Program, that this is all driven by local government. So local government applies for what they want to do. They scope it out. They're in control of the scope. They're in control of the consultant team. And the entire thing, top to bottom, is locally generated. So when we're using this word we mean sort of the team that is working with the local government to move a project forward.
Yes, it's definitely a real we things, Ted. So any questions or any suggestions for us as we look at these things? I appreciate all of the effort that many of you and your staffs have put into these projects, because we're starting to see some really good growth and change. So now NADA. With the University of Utah is going to tell us about some other transportation and land use connection like programs and what they're doing.
Thanks, Megan.
Should I introduce Megan and the subject maybe?
Absolutely. Dr. Ewing, please.
Thank you. Yeah. So you know that the program, the TLC program, had its origin here in this committee. We were, I think, collectively aware of a few programs. The San Francisco program, Sacramento had a program, but weren't aware of the extent to which MPOs have gotten to the, for want of a better term, the land use planning business by funding
local governments to do smart growth type of projects, studies, and plans. So we ultimately ended up with the TLC program, which has been, as you've seen, a tremendous success. And we became interested in just how many other places in the country have similar programs. And so first we did 10 case studies and published those. And then we said, well, once we had the 10, how many more are out there? So we did a national survey. And NIDA and Amanda Dillon and a bunch of other students at the U contacted all of the MPOs in the country. And this is a report back on the health and status of programs like our own TLC. And I'll just make one little pitch. There'll be a slide in just a second that shows you how the money is spent. And the most common iteration or configuration is to fund both planning, technical assistance on the one hand, and capital investment on the other. We right now are funding the planning and technical assistance, but I envision a day when those plans will be implemented with capital money from WFRC as part of the TLC program.
Thank you so much. And I appreciate you being here and look forward to this information.
So, good morning. Thank you for the meeting. I'm here to present MPO transportation funding for livable communities, which we call these kind of programs TLC, or Transportation Land Use Connected Programs. So as all of you know that MPOs are responsible for regional transportation planning, and on the other hand, local governments are in charge of doing land use planning. So basically there is a lack of coordination between MPOs and local government, and that's how TLC programs just emerge to gap the, fill this gap and bridge this gap.
Can I ask that you speak a little more into the microphone? It needs to be picked up and it will be easier that way. Thank you.
So I'm not going to go back to the news story or, oh, thank you. Or background of that, but if I wanted to mention, there are two, the first two MPOs that just conduct TLC program were Metropolitan Transportation Communities in Bay Area in San Francisco and Atlanta Regional Commissions in Georgia. And since 2000s, other MPOs just interested in starting TLC program. But most recently in 2018, Rutland just published best practices in metropolitan transportation planning. So after that, other MPOs started to do TLC program as well. The research questions of this study mostly was about the MPOs and TLC programs objects or goals, and whether the programs are growing across the MPOs, what are the impacts on their communities, or if they even measure the impacts of TLC on their communities as well. So to answer those questions, a couple of students at the MRC just reached to 402 MPOs across the United States by email to see if they do have TLC program running in their MPOs or not. So 27 of MPOs responded yes, they do have TLC program, and 65 of them said that they don't have TLC program. This is the map of that 27 MPOs with TLC program across the United States. So we came up with two different surveys for MPOs with TLC program and MPOs without TLC program. For MPOs that conducted TLC program, we were most interested about the funding resources and if they do measure the impacts, funding distribution, and the object and goals of the TLC program. But for those without TLC program, we were curious if they are familiar even with the TLC program, and if they are familiar, even they are interested in starting a TLC program, If they want to start a TLC program, what are the challenges and barriers to start a new TLC program? And I'm sharing the results from the two surveys. First, let's look at the second survey for TLC without program. We asked if they are interested, and as you can see from based on this chart, majority of the NPOs were mildly interested to start a new program, and it's interesting to know that even 60% of them were not familiar with TLC program at all. This is about the survey one, about the NPOs with TLC program. As you can see, there is a growing trend on NPOs interested and they're just conducting TLC program among across the United States. And we can see most growth in 3 years, like 2005 and 2012 and 2017. But this chart doesn't tell the whole story, because after 2014, some of the NPOs just did not continue to conducting or the TLC program, like as far as I remember, Northwestern Indian Regional Planning. And then we just organized a type of support that
we have our technical assistant from Cache Valley Electric who is helping us, or not helping us, I'm not sure. you know, all of our mics just went out?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Yes. Just talk, just keep going. We can talk, like, we're going to challenge you to talk as loud as you can for a moment, okay?
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
So we organized the type of software that NPOs provided for local governments
in three different categories. Including planning, technical assistance, and infrastructure. By planning, we meant that the NPO is just helping and give a grant to the local government for planning project. By technical assistance, we mean that they could send the NPO staff to local governments to give to assist them in their planning project. And also by infrastructure, we meant that they just provide money and financial assistance for them to improving the infrastructure. So, and it's good to know that the Wasatch Front
providing
all three kinds of support, which is planning, technical assistance, and infrastructure. This is the funding resources. As you can see, the majority of NPOs funding comes from the majority of TLC fundings comes from federal government, but county, local, and state support some financial things and all, as well. And this is the funding cycle and amount awarded by each NPO to the TLC program. And the amount of funding lies on the funding cycle. As you can see, there is an amount of money, about $60 million, because it's like every 4 or 5 years. So this is, the amount of money mostly relies on the funding cycle. Like for the Wasatch Front, it's like $1 million because they just provide that amount of money every year and annually. So after all, we just interested to see if the NPOs track the impact after finishing the TLC program. And we observed that the majority of survey respondents do not use formal metrics to measure program success after the grant has been awarded. But we observed that most of the NPOs were interested to see if the TLC program goes with the NPO's vision as well. So NPO's vision, including land conservation or reducing VMT, or improvement in air quality, or reducing congestion, and so on. In conclusion, we can see a growing trend between among the NPOs are interested in conducting TLC program, And most of each, as I said before, each program has its own goals, but most of them are interested in providing more travel more trips. And at the end, I think you said that we don't have to go through the recommendation, but you just put the recommendations here to see why and how to track impacts and measure what matters. But other recommendations are being developed. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your efforts.
Yeah, we have two things.
Thank you. Yeah, two things that we could share with the committee. One would be the case studies, which are fairly detailed for 10, and I believe the Wasatch Front Regional Council is one of the 10, but they're fairly lengthy case studies for the other 9, plus us. And then the other thing we can share with you is our final report on the national survey, which is what Nada just presented. We have, of course, we have those same charts and a lot of narrative that goes with that. We'd love to.
I personally would love that. So, yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
We can send it to, how's the best way to distribute that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, right, Ted, if they share that with us, we can distribute it, Mary, to everybody here. And I just want to make one, can I say just a few things real quick? First of all, I want to express appreciation for this committee. Some of you have been on this committee for a long time. As Professor Ewing said, the TLC program emerged from this committee years ago, and it's grown and grown. Last year, as many of you know, the state, for the first time, appropriated some resources to do efforts like TLC around the entire state. And those funds are going to UDOT. Andrea and the team are managing those resources. And it's just exciting to see this kind of thing expanding. As Professor Ewing is saying, there's more to be done in this space. And what he's recommending is that capital funding follow planning and technical assistance. I think that is something that, in a way, is already happening, in that the criteria that are being utilized to program capital dollars by WFRC and now increasingly by UDOT and other organizations are considering TLC-like considerations. So are projects serving centers? In other words, not just transportation metrics, but land use and housing and economic development metrics. So it's not TLC-specific capital funding, but they're tied together. And that may be a way to think about this. Are the dollars that we're putting into capital investment serving the broader goals of community development, particularly in a region like ours where there's limited space to grow? So you have to think about, like Julie was saying before, under Wasatch Choice, where matters? Transportation, housing, economic development, coordinating them together, and having funding follow these community plans that are funded through TLC or other programs can be really, really helpful. Okay. Reed and I are going to have a discussion now. Yeah. You can all listen in.
This is going to be a very short discussion. The cool thing about the programs that have both infrastructure and investment and planning and technical assistance is that the planning and technical assistance precedes the infrastructure investment and is to qualify for the infrastructure funds. You have to have completed a plan. So there's a nice marriage of the two, but I would never disagree with my friend Andrew.
I don't have to say anything else then.
Okay, thank you. And it's pronounced Nega. Is that how you say your name? Best of luck to you as you finish up your doctoral program. Thank you for your efforts. Thank you for being here.
Nice job.
Very well done. Okay, moving on. Item 4 on our agenda, we have our new state transportation funding prioritization criteria, which we are all looking forward to learning more about. Regional Growth Committee guides the long-range planning process for this, and after the Unified Transportation Plan is developed, then UDOT takes phase 1 projects to prioritize which projects get the funding first, and that's something we all clamor for. It's something we all want. We all have projects, and so I think we're probably all very interested in learning the new prioritization criteria. With the state funding level close to $700 million annually, this is a big deal. And so we have Richard Brockmeyer here, who is the planning manager at UDOT, to share this new criteria with us.
Thanks. I was hoping the mic would just stay off. I'm not a fan of microphones, but just to give you a little bit of background, and I will try and explain any acronyms I use. I suffer from saying too many acronyms without explaining what they are, but TIF, which is the Transportation Investment Fund, and TTIF, the Transit Transportation Investment Fund, is basically what this prioritization process is all about, is decision-making, helping decision-making for funding projects, capacity projects with those two funds. So TIF has been in place since 2005. It's the major source for capacity funds for highway historically. But there's been recent legislative updates, SB 136 and then 72 and 34. One that, 136 created this whole new fund, the transit fund, which can be used for capital transit, and then expanded eligibility for both funds, with 72 opening up those funds for active transportation and first last mile types of projects. And it also recommended some specific things to consider in the prioritization process, things like local land use plans, economic development, access to employment, things of that nature. The legislation does require a written prioritization process. That's a holdover that's been required, but the previous model or decision-making support tool really hadn't been majorly updated since about 2005. It was primarily focused on looking at transportation specifically and none of these other kind of components. So we've been working over the last 7 months or so, actually a little bit longer than that. We kicked this off in August of 2018, but really focused in on the last 7 months on developing with internal and external stakeholders these decision support tools that I'll go into. We're trying to balance simplicity and complexity, making it simple enough that people can understand why projects are being ranked the way that they are, what's going into the model. It's not a black box, but complex enough that we're doing something meaningful and really creating meaningful differences in the ranking process. We're also addressing some of the known issues that we knew existed with the previous model. We're trying to compare across different project types and geographies. We've set up a whole framework that I'll talk about to do, maybe allow future cross-asset evaluation, cross-modal evaluation, although we're not there yet right now. We've set up this model and framework to do that. And then this bottom point is probably the most important, is that we're anticipating continual improvement and refinement to these decision support tools. Not only does the framework need to be evaluated per legislation, I'll talk about what that is in just a second, it needs to be reviewed annually, but there's going to be different ways of and different data sources that we'll want to tap into in the future. So this is very much a version 1.0, and we anticipate that this would be changed over time. And ultimately, that's up to the Transportation Commission. This is their tool. This is their resource. And so any change would go through the Transportation Commission. So talking about the framework, we're starting, basically this is an implementation step of Utah's transportation vision, and hopefully most of you have heard about that by now, or U-Vision as it's called, with sort of the framework of good health, better mobility, strong economy, and connected communities leading to the pathway for quality of life, maintaining quality of life, and improving quality of life. So there's two capacity programs that these models support, TIF Highway, TTIF Transit, but then you can see that there's sort of four modes that can be funded in terms of types of projects. And so we've created four different models to help with that. The framework across all the models is the same, no matter what model we're talking about. And this is that U-Vision framework. We're always looking at good health, strong economy, better mobility, and connected communities. And then underneath that, we're always going to look at things, for example, good health, safety, public health, environment. The measure that we're using may be different depending on which model we're talking about, But those are things that we're consistently looking at, whether it's a highway project, an active transportation project, or a transit project. So this is a lot to throw at you, and if anybody has questions on specifics, we can come back to this. But this is sort of the model with the weighting. So the weighting works with the U-Vision framework is weighted a certain way, and then within each one of those, the specific criteria, and you can see the measures underneath the criteria that that make that up. So we have the highway model. The transit model looks very similar. So again, we're always looking at those same outcomes or framework and that same criteria set, but there's slight differences. And so for example, with throughput in the highway model, we're looking at existing and future projected highway volumes. With transit, we're talking about what the estimated system ridership increase would be, for example. The active transportation model looks very similar again in terms of the framework, but again, the measures are slightly different based on the context of those project types. And the first last mile is very similar to the active transportation, really, with the only difference being the throughput measure again, where we're talking about station ridership. So, yeah, Ted.
Can I just quickly interject? Oh, I think you're just about to get at what I was saying. I know there's a lot of interest in the weighting and in the criteria, and I see RGC members taking photos. How can they get this information?
Great setup. Thanks, Ted. So all of this is publicly available. So there is a administrative rule that was recently sort of moved on to the next step by the Transportation Commission. I think it's getting posted next week for public comment with an effectuation date of hopefully November 21st, that all of this would be, you know, the rule in place. As part of that rule, this document is referenced. This is basically an extension of the administrative rule, and this is where you can get into the nitty-gritty details of the weighting, of the criteria, of what each measure is, what data source that measure comes from, and how we're using it in the model. So if you're looking for light reading tonight, you know, there's something to put you to sleep. But I'm happy, when we get to the question component of this, happy to go back to any of those measures, or just leave it up for a little bit longer so you can take a look. But that's really a great resource to dive into the models. One other thing I just want to make sure we highlight is how things are, there's a whole nomination component to this for all of these types of projects. So in the case of the highway process, we are going to start with what is in the long-range transportation plan in phase one. And anything that's over $5 million in that plan and on a state facility will be prioritized without anybody having to do anything. That's just where we're starting the baseline. There is a process that the commission can consider other projects outside of phase one, so long as it was a phase one need in the planning process. There's also a local nomination that can happen where if it's outside of a phase one, fiscally constrained and wasn't considered a phase one need, that could be nominated by a local government, but it's up to the commission's discretion on whether that's added to the list or not for ranking. On the TIF active,
go ahead, Richard, just one thing, because particularly for us here at WFRC, this linkage between the prioritization process and the planning process is super important, and I actually haven't seen this slide before. I really like it. That's good stuff. Thank you. I just think it's important for people to understand when we draw this distinction between things that are in projects that are in phase one of the plan automatically will go through the prioritization process, and then you said other projects that are identified as a phase one need may be considered. What that means is, and you all, I'm sure you all know this, remember this, as members of RGC, when we go through our process of looking at projects, we first look at needs. What projects are needed and when are they needed based on anticipated growth and travel demand, right? But we don't have the money, we don't anticipate having the money to fund all of those projects when they are needed. So some projects are identified as needed in the first 10 years, but then we don't have the resources, so they get pushed out of the financially constrained long-range plan into later phases. And so this, Richard, I just think it's an important point that the Transportation Commission can say, hey, if a project was identified in the long-range plan process as being needed in the next 10 years, we can look at prioritizing it, because we wouldn't want just the fact that there aren't resources available to stop even the consideration of putting resources to it. That would be sort of contrary to logic, right? So that's the distinction between all projects in the funded plan get prioritized, and then other projects needed, but maybe not with funding identified, can be considered.
Thanks, Andrew.
Okay, thank you.
And one other point I should make on all of these, the ranked list is, and I've been calling it a decision support tool for a specific reason, that ultimately the funding decision lies with the Transportation Commission, and they can decide to fund things differently than how the model spits out sort of the ranking. They could go down 1, 2, 3 and fund it that way, or there may be a reason to fund things differently, either cash flow reasons or things outside, external to the model that we can't quite capture within the model. That's up to the commission to make that determination. They have to do so in a commission meeting. But ultimately, this is, you know, what the model puts out is not necessarily how things are going to get funded. So I think that's an important thing to note. On the active process, it's fully a nomination process, so we don't start with a project list to begin with, like the highway side. Projects are nominated by a local government or a district. There's a couple of sort of screening criteria to make it onto the list after that. So is it an approved active transportation plan, a UDOT approved active transportation plan? There has to be a demonstration of how that project will mitigate traffic congestion, demonstrate that the local government will be responsible for the maintenance. And I think with this, it's important to note that these are standalone active transportation projects, so they may or may not be on a state facility. So that's sort of the reason for this maintenance component, is this does not necessarily mean that a project has to be on a state facility. This could be on a local road or a multi-use path off a roadway. One thing that this doesn't have in the flow chart that's important is it has to be a paved pedestrian or non-motorized project. And then there's a 40% match requirement, which can be an in-kind match. If all those things are sort of checked off, it gets added to the list for ranking. The transit process is also nomination-based, so we don't, again, not starting with a baseline. Things are nominated by a local government or a transit district. There has to be a demonstration of the ongoing funding source for operations and maintenance of that project. So this is about funding capacity, but there has to be a plan for how the operations and maintenance would work for that project, and then a 40% match, and that can be in kind as well. And then there's also this component here of if it's a new fixed guideway project, so we're talking rail or exclusive lane BRT, that would need to be identified, like a highway project, identified in the phase one of the long range plan of whatever area we're talking about. So I think mainly to, again, make this linkage between what's in the long range plan to what we're making funding decisions based on. If those things are met, it's added to the list and ranked.
Richard, may I add, it's Carrie. With respect to transit in the phase one, there is some assumed new revenue that did go into phase one. So just keep that in mind. I think the fifth quarter was assumed. Okay. You know, yeah.
And then the TTIF first last mile process is very similar. Again, it's starting with a nomination process. It has to be demonstrated that there's a responsible party for the maintenance of that project, a 40% match, and then the demonstrate that the project connects to and improves access to a public transit stop or station. So with that, I'm done talking at you and happy to answer any questions you have. Yeah, all right.
So, Richard, when you look at these different criteria, is there an opportunity to demonstrate that a project will change land use, or are they all based on the land use projections that are in the model? Let me unpack that a little bit. So if you put in a freeway or a tracks line somewhere, it's going to make that area much more attractive for jobs, for example. and that will probably change almost all the metrics on here. And similarly, you put in a tracks line, it's going to make the land use be more compact, more walkable, which will have an impact on transportation far beyond the people who just ride that tracks line, right? So is there that opportunity?
So one thing to note, I think with a lot of these, we want to get to more outcome-based measures in the future. Some of these are outcome-based, so what the project actually does as opposed to identifying a need and working off of that. I think we're there with some of these measures and not there with others. To the point about land use, this is another reason I think it's important to take the phase one list and what's been planned, because the land use projections or forecasts for the model, the travel demand model, will reflect that project list. So in a sense, we're sort of already factoring in whatever the land use change of that project would be by using the long-range plan as sort of the starting place for the projects. I think there's probably ways we could improve that in the future, and certainly, again, going back to this is version 1.0, and we're going to figure out different and better ways to do things in the future, but I think actually that's probably maybe more of a strength at this point of being able to start with the long-range plan, because we're anticipating what that land use is.
And that land use and transportation interaction is part of long-range planning. It is part of the Wasatch Choice 2050 is the approach. Can I just, while I am the last one who said something, I just want to note how terrific UDOT has been in working with partners. That includes Wasatch Front Regional Council. It includes UTA, the other MPOs in the state. They've involved private sector folks. They've really done a broad reach out to get feedback to as they went through this process of drafting something for the commission to consider. And I just want to thank Richard, Andrea, Terry, Ben, and the UDOT team for that. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Anybody else?
Go ahead.
Let me just ask a basic question. The dynamics of our economy is such that there's always changes taking place. And obviously there needs to be some element where, in fact, we assess the current situation or the short-term planning situation and how that will factor, okay, in terms of how this will work. It would be easy for all of us to simply say that I'm looking out 10, 12 years from now and say if everything stays constant, everything stays on path, then we're going to be ready 10, 12 years ago to be able to meet that requirement. And as you know, phase one for TFIF funds would basically be from, what, 2019 to 2030. I think that's the phase one timeline. What's interesting about that is that things are dynamic and they are changing. And let me just give you a perfect example of this dynamic change. For some reason, and we're still trying to understand the reasoning behind it, two important things took place in northern Utah. One is that Northrop Grumman made a decision, okay, that they're going to put a headquarters for their bid on a strategic-based missile program they're bidding on. It's a $60-80 billion program. And as a result of that decision, they have now elected to go to a place, if you're not familiar with a place called Falcon Hill. Instead of being, we call Falcon Hill South, it's going to move now to Falcon Hill North. And they've already broken ground now on a, well, at this point, it's going to be $250,000 square foot office facility with a plan to basically go as high as 500,000 square feet. We're talking literally about thousands of jobs that are going to be put on the north end of Hill Air Force Base under this Falcon Hill project, and the infrastructure is not ready to accommodate that massive change. That just happened. The dynamics of that is, and it's a frustrating point for me, and I won't know the answer to what's going to happen until about the 13th of December when we get a feel for whether the defense bill is approved by Congress. But they are needing this building and this infrastructure basically in place to accommodate this massive amount of insertion to meet this contract demand, okay, and have it in place by August of this next year. Now that's an interesting challenge, when in fact one of the concerns we're facing right now would be is, do we have the transportation infrastructure in place to be able to accommodate that change? That's a significant change to Northern Utah. And so when we look at that is that we do have projects, and UDOT does have projects in there that's in the phase one plan, but we don't anticipate, to be honest with you, on the current path that we will see any type of infrastructural adjustments probably until 2026, 2027. And yet the demand just changed significantly, putting us literally 5-6 years of having to cope with the very changing dynamics of that interstate, particularly I-15 at that location. So now, having now this new, revelation of this expansion of economical growth, how do we adjust to that? And is this program dynamic enough then, Rich? Can we basically come in and find the process to insert this in basis? The landscape has changed dramatically. No cost for us. I like to say that we in the northern part of the state have simply had a part of this, but that didn't happen. This is something that basically has happened because they issued a contract, Northrop Grumman is bidding on it, and they're now basically going to come in and they're going to plan it right here in northern Utah, and we now have to deal with that. Wonderful economical opportunity, couldn't be more excited about the opportunity, but the fact is, the impact in transportation issues is phenomenal. And I'm not so sure we're ready for it. And now we have to step back, look at this wonderful opportunity, and figure out how we're going to adjust to this. So here's my question. That's a long way to reach the question. How do we then take this new bit of information and insert this into this process now so that we can at least step back and say, does it warrant then maybe a little bit of adjustment in terms of that phase one scheduling plan to see if in fact maybe it might be accelerated or needs to be accelerated?
And let me start, because I think there's a lot in that question, but as a starting point, the transportation plan, Utah's Unified Transportation Plan, is not a once every 4 year. It is adopted as an entire system once every 4 years, but then acknowledging that this kind of thing happens, there is an opportunity for amending that plan, at least on an annual basis, and if need be, even more often than that. And so we all recognize communities, transportation partners, that the future, we can't predict it exactly, and things like this, it's a great opportunity and we need to embrace it. And so that's part of the process of exploring amendments to the plan. That's part of it.
And I would say, just to say, we've tried to add flexibility to the, I think it's great that our legislature said that this really is a decision support tool, but the decision and funding decision lies with the Transportation Commission. And so we've added the flexibility in there. We have that flexibility, one, within the rule that they can consider things that are maybe a phase one need, but we're not in the fiscally constrained side. But then also take into account things that some models are useful, but they're all wrong. So I think having the flexibility to take into consideration things that we can't capture in a model is important, and we have that ability, or the Transportation Commission has that ability to say, there's something external that maybe our model is not capturing. The end result of that, but there's an opportunity at least to have that discussion of what are things external to the model of this ranking system, because there are other states where they have a similar process, and what the model spits out in terms of 1, 2, and 3, that's how they fund. And we're lucky to not have that be the case.
Okay, so just one last comment then on that. We surely look at this as a wonderful opportunity, and we surely want to basically embrace it, but we want to plan for this and not react to it. Unfortunately, we found ourselves in a reaction mode today. What is the process now? We've got this edification of new information just came to us. They've broken ground on this infrastructure. I've talked to the developer and says they're going to talk now about building another building right next to it. Here's the question. With this new information, how do we infuse this into the process? And obviously this body needs to be part of that, but Rich, should we be preparing then when the Transportation Commission basically visits our region, and they do a good job at doing that, should we go into that particular discussion with them and basically present this new change, this new evolution that's taking place in northern Utah?
I'm gonna have Ben answer that question.
Yeah, I believe that that's always an opportunity to give input to the Transportation Commission. One thing that I would point out that I thank Terry for reminding, is that as far as the TIF goes, it is currently programmed out to 2024. And this process, this change in this process does not change, we're not going back to projects that are already funded. So that's an additional challenge with this whole thing and the timing and those dynamic situations that you talked about. So that is a challenge, but I mean, there's always ways to talk about it and plan for these kind of dynamic changes.
And I think that was my whole point. If I can be so blunt, we've already planned this to 2024. Any type of possible relief at this moment is really going to be after that. So the municipalities, okay, the counties, are going to have to live with this traffic, I'm going to be very blunt, nightmare for at least 4 or 5 years before there's relief, and then there's the 2 or 3 years to get through the development and completion of a project. So I only suggest to you is that that's the dynamics of this, and as all, we can't get the models to work always to our benefit, but I will suggest to you is we got a challenge coming. Okay, and we're going to have to live with that challenge. And it's not just UDOT. UDOT's going to take a lot of hit on this because there'll be a lot of complaints. But the municipalities, and particularly the mayors, get the phone calls too, okay? And we do the best we can to try to accommodate. So I just want to recognize the fact is that we just need to be aware that there are some things that sometimes get dropped on us, and then we have to kind of figure out how we're going to implement. And I personally do not like to react. I like to plan. That's it.
Okay. May I just add one other piece here? Mayor, what you're talking about, the additional development, additional jobs, means that there's going to be additional economic activity in the area, additional sales taxes. It may translate to higher property values. Relatively recently, in 2018, we, as some of you may remember, a new tool was built into our statutes called the Transportation Reinvestment Zone. It's a tool for capturing additional incremental value associated with infrastructure. There may be a way in this area, if there's anticipated sales tax growth or property appreciation and value, to use a TRZ to capture some of that value within a designated zone, and then use that to reinvest in infrastructure improvements that are associated with the growth that's coming. I don't know if it would fit for this specific circumstance, but this is a new tool, and that is within the control of the local governments and the transportation agencies. So the county, the cities in the area, UDOT, UTA, could be parties to a TRZ if there was a desire to say, look, we need more transportation investment, and we know we're going to be getting incremental revenue from sales or property taxes, and we want to capture a portion of that and use that to pay for transportation investments, which has the potential to accelerate, if there's more money available, some of those investments. And it'd be a little complex to put it all together, but there are some tools, I think, that are in place now that were not available before, and that could be something we could talk about in more detail.
Thank you, Andrew. Mayor Dandoy, we feel for you. And wish you and the whole area the best of luck and appreciate everybody here.
Mayor, let's follow up after the meeting and talk about next steps.
Okay, thank you so much. We appreciate it, Richard. Okay, item 5 on our agenda is exploring road usage charges in Utah. This was something we said we wanted to get a lot more information about. We'd like to understand how this works. We have a new program here in the state that utilizes road usage charges as an alternative to the gas tax to help pay for road maintenance. It is optional and only affects electric and hybrid vehicle owners. But Tiffany Pocock is here from UDOT. We appreciate you being here, and we look forward to the information you have to share with us about this.
Thank you. These first couple slides, I think you guys have all seen before, but I just want to take a step back and do a little reminder. In 2018 and 2019, Senate Bill 136 and 72 directed UDOT to investigate a road usage charge, and also challenged us to implement a program by January 1st, 2020. You know, the purchasing power of the fuel tax has been recently declining. Well, not recently, it's been steadily declining now, you know, since 2003. And we benchmarked that for a reason, I don't remember, but Utah legislature has enacted some countermeasures, however. One, we indexed the CPI to kind of help with the construction inflation, as well as some of the sales tax goes towards transportation funding. This is the lookout of Utah's fleet. 98% are still gas and diesel. So we're only talking about 2% of the fleet that we're impacting here in January 1st. As you can see, though, the electric vehicles and hybrids are growing rapidly at about 50% each year, as well as the hybrids. I can't see all that far, but you can kind of tell the green is the electric vehicles, and again, they're kind of growing at a 40% rate each year. The purple there is the plug-ins and gas hybrids. They're still, I mean, not as dramatic as the EVs, but they're still growing at about 10 to 15% each year as well. And then that orange there is just the gas, gas and diesel vehicles. And, you know, granted they are growing, but, you know, not as a substantial rate. So Utah drivers, and these are all assumptions, Utah drivers, most of our vehicles are about at the 20 mile per gallon range. And those people are paying around $2,300 each year in gas and taxes. The gas is the orange, so the majority of the chunk there, and then the blues are the gas tax that you're paying. And so for now, electric vehicles, you know, they aren't paying as much. As you can see, it's about $600. The yellow is the electricity that you're paying for, but because they aren't paying at the pump, that blue chunk, the green is their new, the fees that they'll be paying at registration. So, you know, we're mid-October now, so, you know, we're knee-deep in implementation for our January 1st launch. As a matter of fact, this week we had a pretty significant all-hands meeting to make sure that all of these elements are good to go for the January launch. Some of the elements that the initial system will have is obviously technology. We'll have telematics for those cars that are built in, like the Tesla 3s. We'll be reporting directly. Otherwise, vehicles can have an OBD2 device. That's those little black things that you can plug into your dash that will report to our commercial account manager, or CAM. Our advisory committee helped us out a lot with privacy. That was one of the big hot topics of, you know, how do we aggregate that information. And again, our commercial account manager, CAM, is helping us out with that. They're actually going to be collecting all that data and aggregating it before we even see it, so we're not going to know where you're at or when. But that information is important for us to get back. We do need to work, you know, because that information exists, we'd like to see it and know, you know, these types of corridors are getting a lot of use. Just kind of helps with probably that prioritization, if you will. The other thing that our system has is, you know, that goes with privacy, is it's an optional program. You don't have to be a part of our road usage charge. You are going to be paying a fee if you are a part of, or you are an owner of an alternative vehicle, like the hybrids and the electric vehicles and the plug-ins. But you can opt into the road usage charge and kind of pay as you go. The vehicle types, like I've mentioned, are the electrics, the plug-ins, and the gas hybrids are the ones that are eligible for our program right now. But I'll go over some of our future ideas a little later. Enrollment's all online, and one of the things that are unique to the Utah system is that we have a direct connect with the DMV database. So as you're going in online and enrolling. Our system, or the commercial account manager, is talking directly to the DMV database, so they'll know exactly that you are eligible. They will do an odometer capture so that we can true up each year. And so that's been really cool and exciting to see. We actually had a demo of that this week. And again, we've had our commercial account manager on board for several months now. We've been working with them for, again, that launch in January. That commercial account manager is eMovis, if that is meaningful to anybody. Again, another big component of this is it's a choice, right? You don't have to opt in if you are concerned about the privacy or anything like that. You can just play the flat fee, and those are what the fees initially look like. Or you can pay the 1.5 cents per mile. And it's also important to note that we aren't disincentivizing you to go into the program. You would only pay 1.5 cents up to that cap. So it's not like if you were driving more than 8,000 miles a year, you wouldn't be paying $200 versus $150 for the flat fee. You would just go up to the flat fee. That's a lot. I'm sorry, but let me walk you through what this is trying to say. This is kind of our projections for the next 5 years for eligible people that could go into the program, as well as our forecast for who we think will opt into the program. The blues are the hybrids, and as you can see, like I mentioned, they're growing at about a 15% rate, so that's why, you know, that bar is going up. But you'll notice that the green, which is still electric vehicles, they are, again, doubling each year. So, you know, by 2023, we're looking at most of the eligible people that are paying these fees to be electric vehicles. The pie charts over there are who we think are going to be enrolled in RUC. Again, the bar charts are these people are going to have to pay a fee, whether it's through RUC or through the flat fee. The pie charts are talking about who is actually a RUC enrollee, if you will. And again, by 2023, you'll notice that pie chart is mostly green. That's because the electric vehicle people are the ones that are paying the higher amount, the $120. I'll go back a slide to show you that. So at $20 for a gas hybrid, you may not be incentivized to go in online and go through that process. You probably would just pay your fee. But that's why we anticipate most people that are opting into the program to be the electric vehicles. And that becomes substantial from a revenue standpoint, because again, they are, you know, compounding each year, doubling each year. So again, that's kind of a lot, but it's the same idea. The reason why the green is so dramatic here is because, again, they're the ones that are paying the $120 versus the $20. So most of the revenue from these fees are going to be from the electric vehicles. And again, most of the money coming in from RUC will be from the electric vehicles. And kind of the short version of that is we're looking at about $800,000 over the next 5 years that we expect from RUC, and about $17 million for flat fees. And those are paying for their use of the system, right? The people that aren't paying at the pump, we're trying to just make sure that they're contributing to the system that they get to use as well. And as you can tell from several slides back, we're not trying to disincentivize people from buying electric vehicles either. Again, you can see that they're paying far, far less in taxes than the gas users. I just want to take a step back and talk a little bit about RUC on a national scale. Again, Utah is not the only one just dabbling in this sandbox. The blue color is what's called RUC West, and Utah is part of that. The green color is the I-95 Corridor Coalition. And all those states are kind of participating either in a pilot or are researching RUC. The reason why Utah and Oregon have a orange perimeter around them is because we are the only states that have implemented an ongoing system. this too is just to kind of show you that on a national scale, states are having to, because of that purchasing power declining, are having to look at generating some fees one way or the other. The green from 2018 to 2019 are states that have adopted annual fees, and the yellow are states that are considering it. And as you can tell, that's rapidly increasing. Again, just to kind of compare ourselves, the annual flat fees on average for electric vehicles across the nation is $127. We're a little bit below that, as you can see on the bottom chart there. But we're significantly less than the plug-ins and the gas hybrids. We're at, you know, $50 and $20 compared to $85 and $60. Speaking more to kind of what's going on a national level, a lot of states are looking at demand responsive pricing. New York, Seattle, Oregon, and San Fran have pilots that are looking into that. Some states are looking at interoperability, and that's just, you know, you can tell that Washington and Oregon, you know, because they have several users that are crossing state boundaries, how is it fair that we're paying a road usage charge to this state when I'm driving in another state? That becomes pretty important to Utah as well, and I'll talk about what we're going to maybe pilot here in a couple of years. If tolling integration, the I-95 corridor is looking at that. That green swath on the East Coast, they're heavily looking at tolling options. And then, true to Utah, there's been some concern about the rural and low-income disconnect that may happen there, so we're looking into that as well. So some future elements that we're looking at in Utah to expand the program is increasing the eligible vehicles, like high NPG users or fleets like Uber and stuff like that. Interoperability, like I mentioned, a lot of Utah drivers go to Idaho and Wyoming, and how is it fair that we're going to collect all that? And that's part of the differentiation as well. So finally, the integration we're looking at as well about tolling. Our current pay system is similar to how, if anybody has those dongles that pay for the hot lanes, they're like a prepaid wallet. So we're trying to sync up all of those systems so that you can kind of be a part of as many platforms as you want to. And with that, I'm done. Any questions?
Tiffany, thank you.
You're welcome.
Appreciate you being here. Thank you for information.
Just a quick note that all of the presentations from today will be available on our website this week, certainly, and likely even today. So just a note.
I just want to say that the gas tax has been and will continue to be for some years, I think, the workhorse of paying for transportation. But this is the future, not just in terms of paying for, but also in terms of all of the power that it gives to implementing different policy choices. The data that comes in, and I think UDOT is doing exactly the right thing, which is right now just experimenting with the technology and really leading the nation in experimenting with this technology. And it's not really experimenting because, as was noted, it's not just a pilot. It's a real program. We're out in front.
January 1. Mark your calendars. Go
sign up. And right now what they're doing is they're saying, look, nobody's going to pay more because of this. It's revenue neutral. And I don't know if you guys would say this. I'll say, but it creates the opportunity in the future to utilize this system to match up with all sorts of demand responsive pricing approaches. When are people traveling? Variable pricing, the types of vehicles that are being utilized. So as a policy tool as we go forward, it has the potential to be incredibly powerful. So we're just at the tip of the iceberg here in terms of what this may mean for us in the future. And I think we should be proud and engaged about what UDOT is leading and what we're doing in this state, staying at the forefront of transportation. So thank you.
I believe actually our chairman.
Bob Stevenson.
If you have an EAP at this time and you sign up for the test period, I believe you save money by doing this registration for your office.
So you're going to, yes and no. Right now, so starting January 1, if you opt into the program, then yes, you would pay as you go. And, you know, drive less, pay less theory. Otherwise, if you were to, if your registration was up in January and you paid your registration, you can still opt into our program, but you've already paid your fee. So now you would just be using the added benefit that our program would have. Like, we've got add-ons like Find My Car and different elements that you can use while you're now a RUC enrollee. And then next year, like if in January when you register again, you wouldn't pay anything because you were in the RUC program. Yep.
Go ahead. Thank you. So, okay, I'm going to be the skunk at the picnic. So I'm sure there's others in the room who drive an electric vehicle. And I fear a little in a state like Utah that's so privacy-oriented. Like, I know the conversation in my house when I tell my husband about the two options, the one 20 or the other. I mean, I don't think he said privacy, you know, freak or anything. But I think there will be some. So I wonder if we can find a way to encourage the legislature to look at the data, see if we're getting enough people enrolled. Because I do think the long-term opportunity, I think, has benefits, but I have concerns as well about the idea of our roads as a marketplace. I mean, I look at, as we all do, about making sure there's equity and fairness for people without means. And I think when we start to look at pricing, as we already have for commuters, right, in the commuter lanes and such, that's good. But I think these are the idea that we're gonna use data to now drive these policies, if we're not, so two things. One is, I think we need to watch this, and I know UDOT was directed to do this, and I see some advantages, certainly. I personally favor raising the gas tax and finding a way to compensate through a registration or another means. Areas like rural areas who have challenges with a lot of area to travel. But given this is probably easier to implement and is a beginning of our process, I can live with it. But I'll say this, I think that we are, until we get beyond those drivers, we're going to be not getting to where you're wanting to go, Andrew, and that when we do go there, we have to be, I mean, I would hope that Wasatch Front will take the lead with UDOT on some very forward-thinking policies around it, because it's a new world to be able to create, you know, financial inequity on a roadway, and what does that mean, and good and bad, right? So just some thoughts, and again, I don't mean to be the skunk at the picnic, but I think there's a lot to this.
No, and I that's why I think the legislature was actually was wise to make it a choice, right? Because of the people who have concerns about privacy. You don't have to be enrolled in RUC. You don't have to have the download. You can opt to just pay at the counter at the DMV. Your share of using the system that is there.
And one last point. I think that the people who choose primarily an electric vehicle with no emissions, we're paying for it by our contribution to the, first of all, they're higher priced, and we're paying for it through our lack of impacts, right? We all are driving air quality. I just did a survey and asked an open-ended question to residents within the county, what is your number one concern? And even when the air was pretty good, air quality is still number one. So we have to, be as policymakers, continue to understand that and the complexity in air quality choice. And on this Wasatch Front, at least, and in my county, it is the number one priority. So you add it, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, because I get how these things roll out, and UDOT does a great job at working with legislative intent and a mandate here. But I think If for 1 minute, you know, the $120 didn't impact my decision, I still got the car. It's a second electric car I've driven, love, and will probably always have an electric vehicle for so many reasons. But we are, those of us who make that choice are paying more to do it up front. And then additionally, the 120 won't stop me, but I don't want that fee to be a barrier for anyone. And my point on the participation is with the choice, I think we may not get the data, maybe I'm wrong, but the deep data, I think you will see the vast majority over time choose the easier route. I might be wrong, but just some thoughts.
I appreciate it, thank you.
And all in all, I'm not dead set against this, I just think it's really important that we continue to find as policymakers measures to get people into electric vehicles, because it is the wave of the future, and that, and accepting that and knowing that and finding and understanding that, what, I mean, imagine if that was the only automobile choice right now, or the only trucking choice, or the only school bus choice, how that would impact what my residents are saying is the number one issue in this county right now.
So, Jenny, do I understand what you're saying is your concern that this program is going to create a negative going to electric vehicles?
I do think it's an additional barrier, yeah, for already an expensive cost compared to a traditional gas vehicle. I think we should continue to provide a full incentive, and that we should, until we don't have an air quality issue, provide that incentive. It's just my opinion. So I think that anybody who makes that choice should get a freebie to counter the pollution, quote, roads, I get. I mean, I understand that we need to cover, but I think that it, in this era of consumer choice, there's probably a way to mitigate that impact without creating an additional barrier. As we want to encourage people to move that direction and encourage the industry, in my opinion, more appropriately to move that area. I mean, if there were an option right now to buy a fleet of dump trucks that would not pollute, or big industry trucks, we would find a way to do it at Salt Lake County because of the health impacts that we're facing from air quality. And I think that is as important to remember in this conversation. It's easy to say, hey, our roads, but health is what I would say. So my choice would be to continue the full incentive and encourage industry to continue producing and advancing the technology.
Okay, I'm going to end this discussion here just because we're about 15 minutes over, but thank you, Tiffany, and thank you, Mayor Wilson, and thank you, Commissioner. It's a good discussion. There are unintended consequences, for better or for worse, from all of these kind of decisions, and there's a lot more to figure out. Thank you, all of you, for your input, and a lot of good information to really think about. We made it to item 6. Very quickly, I'm going to give Andrew just a second. We have a new employee here that we look forward to meeting, so I'm going to let you introduce the new addition.
Thank you. We're over time, so I'm going to do this real quick. Nikki Navio is here. Nikki, stand up just for a sec. Nikki just joined us in our long-range planning group, so you all get a chance to know her. We also have another new employee, Lauren, who's not here in the room, but you'll have a chance to meet her as well. So we're just thrilled to have more great folks working with us on our team at WFRC. And so welcome, Nikki. Thank you.
Welcome. Not to make you feel uncomfortable, but I've already heard of you and I've heard great things already about you. So for what it's worth, we're really glad to have you here. Yeah, thank you. Okay, this is our last meeting of the year. Next year, we scope out planning focus areas for the Wasatch Front Regional Council as we begin developing the next plan. Believe it or not, generally the focus will be on addressing disruptive technologies and on-plan refinement. And so I encourage all of you to think through what you think WFRC should focus on to help us improve the quality of life to our region. And think about that before our next meeting. We'll have opportunity to really discuss that. And I love this this discussion that was just being had. I wish we had more time for it, because we have great minds in this room. This is a room full of brilliant people who really care. And I love hearing differing opinions and other things that maybe hadn't been considered. And so think about some of these things before our next meeting as we come and prepare to sit down and discuss. With that, if nobody has any other business, we will look forward to our next meeting on January 16th of 2020, and I will entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Okay. I'm not sure who's keeping track, but did you get that?
No.
Mayor Wilson made the motion, and Councilmember Cannon seconded.
Councilmember
Cannon.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
We are adjourned. Okay.